1.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice. His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
Plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
The role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank's International Monetary Fund, IMF. And the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
For they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
With Cabal, with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
Okay, let me find my cursor there for a second. It's hard to see with all this white on all the screens. Three screens, actually. Welcome to another Cats Look Ball on Shake and Wake Radio, PSN Radio, Soul Flow Radio, and EPGN Radio. And as I like to try to remember each Tuesday, all stations are listener supported, so please hit the donate button if you're able to. I've got a lot less brain fog today than what I had last Tuesday. Had copious amounts of caffeine last Tuesday, and I still couldn't hardly stay awake. Only had one coffee today and one glass of iced tea. I was, today's Tuesday. From like Thursday through Monday, Thursday through Sunday, Wednesday through Sunday, actually just about every day last week, I would wake up one time and then I couldn't get back to sleep. That happened on Monday night last week, and Tuesday, having a lot of brain fog, but feeling pretty good today. I guess I'm going to go back about one paragraph to go over a little bit from last week. The Scientific Outlook by Bertrand Russell. This is obviously absurd. Those who agree with Freud must contend that there is objective truth in his theories. Not merely that they are such as many people can be got to accept. What remains of the theory of social adjustment as a test of truth in its beliefs inspired by purely personal desire are seldom true. I mean, by purely personal desire, those that conflict with the interest of others. Take as an illustration the man who becomes rich on the stock exchange. His activities are, it is true, inspired by the desire to become rich, which is purely personal, but his beliefs must be inspired by an impartial survey of the markets. If his beliefs are personal, he will lose money, and his desires will not be granted. As an illustration shows, even our most personal desires are more likely to be granted if our beliefs are impersonal than if they are personal. This is the reason why science and scientific method are held in esteem. When I say that a belief in impersonal, I mean that those desires which enter into its causation are universal human desires, and not such as peculiar to the person in question. Psychoanalysis as a psychological theory consists in the discovery of the desires, usually unconscious, which inspire belief, especially in dreams and in insane delusions, but also in all the less rational parts. Of our normality, nominally sane working life, considered as a therapeutic psychoanalysis is a technique which aims to substituting personal desires as sources of belief, wherever personal desires have become so dominant as to interfere with social behavior. The technique of psychoanalysis, where adults are concerned, is as yet slow, cumbrous, and expensive. The most important application of psychoanalytic theory are to education. These applications are as yet in the experimental stage, and owing to the hostility of the authorities, they can only be made on a very small scale. It is, however, already evident that moral and emotional education has hitherto been conducted on wrong lines and has produced maladjustments which have been sources of cruelty, timidity, stupidity, and other unfortunate mental characteristics. That's quite odd. Cruelty, timidity, stupidity, and other unfortunate mental characteristics. I guess he's describing every one of the minions that are in control. I think it's possible that psychoanalytic theory may be absorbed into something more scientific, but I do not doubt that something of what psychoanalysis has to suggest in regards to early education will be found permanently valid of immense importance. The behaviorist psychology, which has its experimental basis mainly in the work of Pavlov, but has become generally known through Dr. John B. Watson, is at first sight very different from psychoanalysis and scarcely compatible with it. I am persuaded, however, that there is truth in both, and that it is important to arrive at a synthesis of the two. Freud starts from fundamental desires, such as a sexual impulse, which he conceives as seeking an outlet now in one direction, now in another. Behaviorism starts with an apparatus of reflexes and the process of conditioning. There is perhaps not quite so much different as there seems to be. The reflex corresponds roughly to Freud's fundamental desires, and the process of conditioning to the search for different outlets. As a technique for acquiring power, behaviorism is, I think, superior to psychoanalysis. It embodies the methods which have always been adopted by those who train animals or drill soldiers. It utilizes the force of habit, the strength of which has always been recognized, and as we saw when we were considering Pavlov, it makes it possible both to cause and to cure neurasthenia and hysteria. The conflicts which appear in psychoanalysis is as emotional reappear in behaviorism as conflicts between habits or between a habit and a reflex. If a child were severely beaten every time it sneezed, it is probable that a fantasy world would in time build itself up in his mind around the conception of sneezing. He would dream of heaven as a place where the spirits of the blessed sneeze incessantly. Or, on the contrary, he might think of hell as a place of punishment where those who live in open sternitation. I missed a letter there, sorry. In this sort of way, the problems brought to the fore by psychoanalysis can, I think, be dealt with on behaviorist lines. Projecting, is he, Melissa? Is that what you're saying? At the same time, it should be admitted that these problems, whose importance is very great, would probably not have come to the fore but for the psychoanalytic approach. For the practical purposes of educational technique, I think it will be found that the educator should behave as a psychoanalyst when he is conducting with matters touching powerful instincts, but as a behaviorist in matters which a child views as emotionally important. For example, affection for parents should be viewed for the psychoanalytic manner, but brushing teeth in the behaviorist manner. I need to update my virus protection here quick, so give me a few seconds. So far, we have been considering those ways of influencing the mental lie, which process by mental means, as in psychoanalysis, or by means of the conditioned reflex, as in behaviorism. There are, however, other methods which may in time prove of immense importance. And I need to take a drink. I started talking and my voice got scratchy from the beginning. These are the methods which operate through psychological means, such as the administering of drugs, the curing of cretinism by means of iodine is so far the most remarkable of these methods. In Switzerland, all salt of human consumption is obliged by law to be iodized, and this measure has to be found adequate as a preventative of cretinism. The work of Cannon and other concerning the influence of the ductless glands upon the emotions has become widely known, and it is clear that by administering artificially the substances which the ductless glands provide, a profound effect can be produced upon temperament and character. The effects of alcohol, opium, and various other drugs have been have been familiar. But these effects are, on the balance, harmful unless the drug is taken with unusual moderation. There is, however, no a priori reason why drugs should not be discovered which have a wholly beneficial effect. I have never myself observed any but good effects to flow from the drinking of tea. At any rate, if it is China tea, it is possible that the psychological marvels may have become possible through prenatal treatment. One of the eminent philosophers of the day regards as superiority to his brothers, perhaps humorously, as due to the fact that shortly before his birth, his mother was in a carriage which rolled down the Simplon in an accident. I do not suggest that this method should be adopted in the hope of turning us all into philosophers, but perhaps in time we shall discover some more peaceable means by endowing the fetus, F-O-E-T-U-S, with intelligence. Education used to begin at 8 years old with the learning of the Latin declensions. Now under the influence of psychoanalysis, it begins at birth. It is to be expected that with the evidence of experimental embryology, the important part of education will be found to be prenatal. This is already the case with fishes and newts, but in regard to them, the scientist is not hampered by education authorities. The power of psychological technique to mold the mentality of the individual is still in its infancy and is not fully realized. There can, I think, be little doubt that it will increase enormously in the near future. Science has given us, in succession, power over inanimate nature, power over plants and animals, and finally power over human beings. Each power involves its own kind of dangers, and perhaps the dangers involved in power over human beings are the greatest that, but that is a matter that we will consider at a later stage. Okay, chapter 11, Technique in Society. And I'm going to take another drink before I start this chapter. See if I can keep my voice a little bit. Doesn't seem like I'm going to be able to. Technique in society. The application of science to social questions is even more recent than its application to individual psychology. There are, it is true, a few directions in which a scientific attitude is to be found as early as the beginning of the 19th century. Malthus's theory of population, however true or false, is certainly scientific. The arguments by which he supports it are not appeals to prejudice. Well, actually they are, but to population statistics and the expenses of agriculture. Adam Smith and Ricardo are also scientific in their economics. Again, I do not mean to say that the theories they advance are invariably true, but that their outlook and their type of reasoning is the characteristics which distinguish scientific method. From Malthus came Darwin, and from Darwin came Darwinism, which as applied to politics has turned out to be far more scientific the phrase survival of the fittest, proved too much for the intellects of those who speculate on social questions. The word fittest seems to have ethical implications, from which it follows that the nation, race, and class to which a writer belongs must necessarily be the fittest. Hence, we arrive under the regis of a pseudo-Darwinian philosophy at doctrines such as the Yellow Peril, Australia for the Australians, and the superiority of the Nordic race. On account of the ethical bias, one must view all Darwinian arguments on social questions with the greatest suspicion. This applies not only as direct as between different races, but also as between different classes in the same nation. All Darwinian writers belong to the professional classes, and it is therefore an accepted maxim of Darwinian politics that the professional classes are biologically the most desirable. It follows that their sons ought to get a better education at the public expense than that which is given to the sons of wage earners. In all such arguments, it is impossible to see an application of science to practical affairs. There is merely a borrowing of some of the language of science for the purpose of making prejudice seem respectable. Yes, indeed. There is, however, a large amount of genuine experimental science on social affairs. Perhaps the most important set of experiments is in this realm is that which we owe to advertisers. This material, valuable as it is, has not been utilized by experimental psychologists, because it belongs in a region remote from the universities, and they would feel themselves vulgarized by contact with anything so gross. But anybody who is in earnest in studying the psychology of belief cannot do better than consult the great advertising firms. No test of belief is so searching as the financial one. When a man is willing to back his belief by spending money in accordance with it, his belief must be regarded as genuine. Now this is precisely the test the advertiser is perpetually applying. Various people's soaps are recommended in various ways. Some of those ways produce the desired result, others do not, or at any rate, not at the same degree. Clearly, the advertisement which causes a man's soap to be bought is more effective in creating belief than the one which does not. I do not think any experienced advertiser would suggest that the merits of the respective soaps had any share whatever in bringing about the result. Very large sums of money are paid to the men who invent good advertisements, and rightly so, for the power to cause large numbers of people to believe what you assert is very valuable power. Consider its importance, for example, to the founders of religious. In the past, they often had to adopt most painful forms of publicity. How much pleasanter their lives have been if they could have gone to the agent who would have purchased the respect of their disciples in return for a percentage of the ecclesiastical revenues. For From the technique of advertising, it seems to follow that the great majority of mankind, any proposition will win acceptance if it is reiterated in such a way as to remain in the memory. Most of the things that we believe because we have heard them affirmed. We do not remember where or why they were affirmed, and we are therefore unable to be critical even when the affirmation was made by a man whose income would be increased by its acceptance and was not backed by any evidence whatsoever. Advertisements tend, therefore, as a technique becomes perfected, to be less and less argumentative and more merely striking. As long as it's as an impression is made, the desired result is achieved. Consider scientifically, advertisements have another great merit, which is that their effect, so far as it is known, through the receipts of the advertisers, are mass effects, not effects upon individuals, so that data acquired are data as a mass psychology. For the purposes of studying society rather than individuals, advertisements are therefore invaluable. Unfortunately, their purpose is practical rather than scientific. For scientific purposes, I suggest the following experiment. Let two soaps, A and B, be manufactured, of which A is an excellent and B is an abominable. Let A be advertised by stating its chemical composition and by testimonies from eminent chemists. Let B be advertised by the bare statement that it is the best, accompanied by the portrays of famous Hollywood beauties. If man is a rational animal, more of A will be sold than of B. Does anyone in fact believe that this would be the result? I don't know. Probably not. Well, who knows? People believe science today, so who knows? I guess that's a good place to take a break. Rest my voice for a couple minutes here. I think about 6 minutes, everyone. I can find my mouse again. Oops. Be back in just a few minutes. I don't know what that was, but something popped in there I've never seen before. Get that out. Let's try this one.
Well, I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in.
My friend, and he watches till night.
Okay, and I am back for the second segment. Welcome, Luca. Don't know how you found out I was on air, but good to have you here. Did you get that recording all done yesterday? For Annie? You could smell it. Okay. The advantages of advertisement have come to be realized pretty fully by politicians, but are only beginning to be realized by the churches. When the churches become more fully alive to its advantages as compared with the traditional religious technique, which dates from before the invention of printing. Good. Glad to hear it. We may hope for a great revival of faith. On the whole, the Soviet government and the communist religion are those with hitherto have best understood that the use of advertisement. They are, it is true, somewhat hampered by the fact that most Russians cannot read. This obstacle, however, they are doing their best to remove. This consideration brings us naturally to the subject of education, which is the second great method of public propaganda. Ooh! Bingo! You got it right there, right on the head. Nailed it. Total admission right there in 1938. Education has two very different purposes. On the one hand, it aims at developing the individual and giving him knowledge which will be useful to him. On the other hand, it aims at producing citizens who will be convenient for the state or the church which is educating them. Up to the point, these two purposes coincide in practice. It is convenient to the state that citizens should be able to read, and that they should possess some technical skill in virtue of which they are able to do productive work. It is convenient that they should possess sufficient moral character to abstain from successful crime, and sufficient intelligence to be able to direct their own lives. But when we pass beyond these elementary requirements, the interests of the individual may often conflict with those of the state or the church. This is especially in the case in regard to credulity. To those who control publicity, credulity is an advantage, while to the individual, a power of critical judgment is likely to be beneficial. Consequently, the state does not aim at producing a scientific habit of mind, except in a small minority of experts, who are well paid and therefore, as a rule, supporters of the status quo. Dr. Fauci, right there. probably the year he was born, or somewhere in there, not too far from it. Among those who are not well paid, credulity is more advantageous to the state. Consequently, children in school are taught to believe what they are told and are punished if they express belief. If they express disbelief. There you go, another admission. 1938. In this way, a conditional reflex is established, leading to the belief in anything said authoritatively by elderly persons of importance. You and I, reader, owe our immunity from spoliation. Wonder if that's a misprint. Spoliation. To this beneficent precaution on the part of our respective governments. Of the purposes of the state in education is certainly, on the whole, beneficent. The purpose in question is that are producing social coherence. In medieval Europe, as in modern China, the lack of social coherence proved disastrous. It is difficult for large masses of men to cooperate as much as it is necessary for their own welfare. The tendency to anarchy and civil war is always one to be guarded against, except on those rare occasions when some great principle is at stake, which is of sufficient importance to make civil war worthwhile. For this reason, that part of education which aims at producing loyalty to the state is to be praised insofar as it is directed against internal anarchy. But insofar as it is directed to the perpetuation of international anarchy, it is bad. On the whole, at present in education, the form of loyalty and to the state which is most emphasized is hostility to its enemies. No one was shocked when, in the first half of 1914, the Northern Irish wished to fight against the British government. But everyone was shocked when the second half of the year, some of the Southern Irish would not fight against the Germans. Modern inventions and modern technique have had a powerful influence on promoting uniformity of opinion and making men less individual than they used to be. Read, for example, The Stammering Century by Gilbert Seldes, and compare it with America at the present day. In the 19th century, new sects were perpetually springing up. New prophets were founding communities in the wilderness. Celibacy, polygamy, free love, all had their devotees, consisting not of single cranks, but of whole cities. And somewhat similar mental condition existed in Germany in the 16th century, in England in the 17th, and in Russia until the establishment of the Soviet government. But in the modern world, there are three great sources of uniformity in addition to education. These are the press, the cinema, and the radio. The press has become an agent of uniformity as a result of technique and financial causes. The larger the circulation of a newspaper, the higher the rate it can charge for its advertisements, and the lower the cost of printing per copy. A foreign correspondent costs just as much whether his newspaper has a large or a small circulation. Therefore, his relative cost is diminished by every increase in circulation. A newspaper with a large circulation can hire the most expensive legal talent to defend it against libel suits, and can often conceal from all but serious students its misstatements of facts. Is that what they call lies? Or isn't that what they call lies? Misstatements of facts. I gotta remember that one. I'm not lying. It's a misstatement of fact. For all these reasons, of which advertisements are the chief, big newspapers tend to defeat small ones. There are, of course, small weeklies to please small sets of cranks or highbrows. And there are journals devoted to special interests, such as yachting or fly fishing. But the immense majority of newspaper readers confine themselves either, as in England, to a small number of newspapers, or as in America, to a small number of syndicated groups of newspapers. The difference between England and America is, in this respect, of course, due to size. In England, if Lord Rothermere and Lord Beaverbrook desire anything to be known, it will be known. If they desire it to be unknown, it will be unknown, except for a few pertinacious busybodies. Although there are rival groups in the newspaper world, there are, of course, many matters as to which the rival groups are agreed. In a suburban train in the morning, one man may be reading the Daily Mail and another the Daily Express. But if by some miracle they should fall into conversation, they would not find much divergence in the opinions they had imbibed or in the facts of which they had been informed. Thus, for reasons which are ultimately technical and scientific, the newspapers have become as influence tending to uniformity and increasing the rarity of usual opinions. Another admission right there. They're all getting the same. They're all getting a script. That's what that means. Just normal talk. They're all getting a script. Another modern invention tending towards uniformity is the radio. This, of course, is more the case in England, where it is a government monopoly, than in America, where it is free. During the general strike in 1926, it afforded practically the only method of disseminating news. This method was utilized by the government to state its own case and conceal that of the workers. I was myself at the time in the remote village, almost the furthest from London, I believe, of any village in England. All the villagers, including myself, assembled to the post office every morning to hear the news. A pompous voice would announce, "It is the house secretary who has come to make a statement." I regret to say that the villagers all laughed, but if they had been less remote, they would have probably have been more respectful. In America, where the government has not interfered with broadcasting, one must expect, if the same policy continues, that there will be a gradual growth of big interest analogous to the big newspapers, and that these will cover as large a proportion of the ground as does the syndicated press. Another foresight into today's America in 1938. Well, Luca, he cited Malthusian Society a few minutes ago too, so both of them, Fabian and Malthus. But perhaps the most important of all the modern agents of propaganda is the cinema. Hollywood. Yes, sir. There we go. Where the cinema is concerned, the technical reasons for large-scale organizations leading to almost worldwide uniformity are overwhelming. The costs of a good production are colossal, but they are no less if it is exhibited seldom than if it is exhibited often and everywhere. The Germans and the Russians have their own productions, and those of the Russians are, of course, as important part of the Soviet government's propaganda. In the rest of the civilized world, the products of Hollywood preponderate. The great majority of young people in almost all civilized countries derive their ideas of love and honor of the way to make money, and of the importance of good clothes from the evening spent in seeing that Hollywood thinks good of them. I doubt whether all the schools or churches combined have as much influence as the cinema upon the opinions of the young in regard to such inanimate matters as love and marriage and money making. Oops. My screens went black. It startled me. I forgot to put my video on. Just a few more minutes here. The producers of Hollywood are the high priests of the new religion. There they are. Let us be thankful for the lofty purity of their sentiments. Yeah. That changed. That quickly changed about 25 years later there, Mr. Russell. We learn from them that sin is always punished and the virtue is always rewarded. True, the reward is rather gross, and such as a mortal fashion of virtue might not wholly appreciate. But what of that? We know from the cinema that wealth comes to be virtuous. And from real life that old so-and-so has wealth. It follows that old so-and-so is virtuous. No, it's never been the case there, Mr. Russell. And that the people who say he exploits his employees are slanderers and troublemakers. The cinema, therefore, plays a useful part in the safeguarding the rich from the envy of the poor. It is undoubtedly an important fact in the modern world that almost all the pleasures of the poor can only be provided by men possessed of vast capital by the governments. Are you taking off already, Luca? The reasons for this, as we have seen, are technical, but the result is that any defects in the status quo become known only for those who are willing to spend their leisure time otherwise in amusement. These are, of course, a small minority, and from a political point of view, they are at most times negligible. This is, however, a certain instability with the whole system. In the event of unsuccessful war, it might break down the population, which had grown accustomed to amusements, might be driven by the boredom into serious thought. The Russians, when deprived of vodka by wartime prohibition, made the Russian Revolution. What would Western Europeans do if deprived of their nightly drug from Hollywood? The moral of this for Western European governments is that they must keep on good terms with America. In the American imperialism of the future, it may turn out that the producers of cinemas have been the pioneers. So far, we have been considering the effect of scientific technique upon opinions, which cannot be regarded as a wholly cheerful subject. There are, however, many much better effects. Consider, for example, the matter of the public health. In 1870, the death rate in England and Wales was 22-9, and the infant death rate was 160. And in 1929, these had fallen respectively to 13.4 and 74. This change is attributed almost wholly to scientific technique. Improvements in medicine, in hygiene, in sanitation, in diet, have all played their part in the diminution of suffering and unhappiness represented by these bare statistical facts. In old days, it was expected that about half of the children in a family would die before they grew up. This involved pain, illness, and sorrow to the mother, often great suffering to the children, and a waste of natural resources in the care of children who never lived to become productive. Because that's all the bottom line is, they become productive. Until the adoption of stream transport by land, the sea perpetual famines were inevitable, causing unspeakable anguish in the course of a slow destruction of human life. And not only did people, even in ordinary times, die at a much greater rate than they do now, but they were far more ill, far more often ill. Nowadays in the West, typhus is unknown, smallpox very rare, tuberculosis usually curable. These three facts alone represent a contribution to human welfare, which outweighs any harm that science may be hitherto done in the way of increasing the horrors of war. Whether the balance of this respect will continue to be on the right side in the future is, of course, an open question, but certainly it has been on the right side hitherto. It is a fashion among intellectuals to regard our age as one of weariness and discouragement to them. No doubt it is so, since they have less influence on affairs that they formerly had, and their whole outlook is more or less inappropriate in modern life. But to the average man and woman and child, this is by no means the case. Great Britain has been passing during the last 20 years through an economic depression and war, yet it would seem that the ordinary working class family has lately been better off than the prosperous period of 45 years ago. I think I'll take my break right here. I wonder if he's actually going to get into Germany and Hitler. Because Hitler was obviously in power at this time, 1938. Be kind of curious to see what he has to say about that. I'm going to play, let me see, a couple of Facebook songs. They're on live. I haven't recorded them yet, so they're from the Gaither Group also. I'm going to record them a little bit later, so playing them right now. Be back in about 6 minutes, everyone.
I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the Son of God discloses, and He walks with me, and He talks with me, and He tells me the birds hush
the singing and the melody that he gave to me within.
Okay, welcome back to the second and final hour of the show. And again, I want to thank all of the stations and say that they are all listener supported. And they can't do the thing that they're doing without donations. So please help out Shake and Wake if you can. And PSN Radio, EPGN Radio, and SoFlo Radio. and PSN Radio. I know I marked my spot. I just have to find it. Okay. The introduction of scientific technique into social affairs is as yet very incomplete and haphazard. Take, for example, the matter of banking and credit. Long ago, men took the first step towards scientific technique in this respect when they substituted money for barter. The next step, which did not begin for thousands of years after the introduction of money, was the substitution of banks and credit for cash. Credit has become an immense force controlling the economic life of all advanced communities. but although this, its principles are fairly well understood by experts, political difficulties stand in the way of the right utilization of these principles. And the barbaric practice of dependent upon actual gold is still the cause of much misery. Barbaric practice, huh? No false characterizations going on there, I guess. No propaganda there, folks. Move along. In this, as in other respects, economic forces and technical requirements demand worldwide organization. But the force of nationalism presents obstacles and cause people to endure avoidable sufferings patiently because of the pleasure they derive from the thought that foreigners are suffering even more. The social effect of modern scientific technique is in practically all directions to demand an increase both in the size and intensity of organization. When I speak of the intensity of organization, I mean the proportion of a man's activities that is governed by the fact of his belonging to some social unit. The primitive peasant may be almost entirely self-directed. He produces his own food, buys very little, and does not send his children to school. The modern man, even if he happens to be an agriculturalist, produces only a small proportion of what he needs. If he grows wheat, for example, he probably sows the whole of his crop and buys his bread from the baker like any other man. Even if he does not do this, he has to buy most of the rest of his food. In his buying and selling, he depends upon immensely organizations which are usually international. His reading is provided by the great newspaper, his amusements by Hollywood, the education of his children by the state, his capital, in part at least, by a bank, his political opinions by his party, his safety and many of his amenities by the government, to which he pays taxes. Thus, in all his most important activities, he has ceased to be a separate unit and has become dependent upon social organization. As scientific technique advances, the most profitable size of most organizations increased. A great many respects, national boundaries have become a technical absurdity. There's another admission right there. A great many respects, national boundaries have become a technical absurdity, and further advanced demands that they should be ignored. There's the crony capitalism explained right there. And also crony communism and crony fascism, as a matter of fact. Unfortunately, nationalism is immensely strong, and the increasing power of propaganda which scientific technique has put into the hands of national states, is being used to strengthen our anarchic force. Until this state of affairs is amended, scientific technique will not be able to achieve the results of which it is capable in the way of promoting human welfare. Okay, part three, the scientific society. Chapter 12, Artificially Created Societies. The scientific society with which the following chapters are to be concerned is, in the main, a thing of the future. Although various of its characteristics are adumbrated, I haven't seen that word in a while, in various states at the present day, the scientific society, as I conceive it, is one which employs the best scientific technique in production, in education, and in propaganda. But in addition to this, it has a characteristic which distinguishes it from the societies of the past, which have grown up by natural causes, without much conscious planning as regards their collective purpose and structure. No society can be regarded as fully scientific unless it has been created deliberately with a certain structure in order to fulfill certain purposes. This is, of course, a matter of degree. Empires, insofar as they depend upon conquest and are not mere national states, have been created, it may be said, in order to confer glory upon their emperors, but this has been in the past merely a question of the political government and has made very little difference in the daily life of the people. There are, it is true, semi-mythical lawgivers in the remote past, such as Zoroaster, Lycurgus, and Moses, who are supposed to have impressed their character upon the societies that accepted their authority. Ugh. These pages are still hard to turn. They're so crisp. Sorry about this. I need to move my mic just a little bit. What in the world? Okay, I turned the page, didn't even finish the other page. In all such cases, however, the laws attributed to them must have been, in the main, pre-existing customs. To take an instance concerning which more is known, the Arabs, who accepted the authority of, well, he writes Mohammed, but I'm sure he means Mohammed. He spelled it with a T for some reason. Arabs who accepted the authority of Mohammed made hardly more change in their habits than did Americans who accepted the Volstead Act. When Mohammed's skeptical relatives decided to throw in their lot with him, they did so because of the smallness of the change that he demanded. As we approach modern times, the changes deliberately brought about in social structure become greater. This is especially the case where revolutions are concerned. The American Revolution and the French Revolution deliberately created certain societies which certain characteristics, but in the main, these characteristics were political. And then the effects in other directions formed no part of the primary intentions of the revolutionaries. But scientific technique has so enormously increased the power of governments that it has now become possible to produce more profound and intimate changes in social structure than any that were contemplated by Jefferson or Robespierre. I guess that's how you pronounce that. Robespierre. Scientific first taught us to create machines. It is now teaching us by Mendelian breeding and experimental embryology to create new plants and animals. There can be little doubt that similar techniques will before long give us power within wide limits to create new human individuals differing in predetermined ways from the individuals produced by unaided nature. Transhumanism, right there. And by means of psychological and economic technique, it is becoming plausible to create societies as artificial as a steam engine, and as different from anything that would grow up of its own accord without deliberate intention on the part of human agents. Such artificial societies will, of course, until social science is much more perfected than it is at present, have many unintended characteristics, even if their creators succeed in giving them all the characteristics that they intended. The unintended characteristics may easily prove more important than those that are foreseen, and may cause the artificially constructed societies to break down in one way or another. But I do not think it is open to doubt that the artificial creation of societies will continue and increase so long as scientific technique persists. The pleasure in planned construction is one of the most powerful motives in men who combine intelligence with energy. Whatever can be constructed according to the plan, such men will endeavor to construct. So long as a technique for creating the new type of society exists, there will be men seeking to employ this technique. They are likely to suppose themselves actuated by some idealistic motive, and it is possible that such motives may play a part in determining what sort of society they shall aim at creating. But the desire to create is not itself idealistic, since it is a form of the love of power. And while the power to create exists, there will be men desirous of using this power, even if unaided nature would produce a better result than any that can be brought about by deliberate intention. During the present century, there have been three powers which illustrate the possibility of artificial creation. The three powers in question are Japan, Soviet Union, and Nazi Germany. Modern Japan has, until its defeat, almost exactly what it was intended to be by the men who made the revolution in 1867. This is one of the most remarkable political achievements in all history, in spite of the fact that the purpose which inspired the innovators was simple and such as every Japanese might be expected to emphasize with, to sympathize with. The purpose was, in fact, nothing more recondite than the preservation of the national independence. China had been found important to resist the Western powers, and Japan appeared to be in late case. Certain Japanese statesmen perceived that the military and naval power of the Western nations rested upon Western education and Western industrial technique. They decided to introduce both, which such modifications as Japanese history and circumstances demanded. But whereas industrialism had grown up in the West with very little assistance from the state, the scientific knowledge had developed very far before the Western governments undertook the task of universal education. Japan, being pressed for time, was obligated to impose education and scientific and industrialism by government pressure. It was clearly impossible to effect so great a change in the mentality of the average citizen by merely appeals to reason and self-interest. The reformers, therefore, skillfully enlisted the divine reason of the Mikado and the divine authority of the Shinto religion on the side of modern science. The Mikado had been for centuries obscure and unimportant, but he had already been restored to power once before in the year AD 645, so that there was a precedent of respectability and antiquity for what was being done. The Shinto religion, unlike Buddhism, was indigenous to Japan, but had been for ages thrust into the background by the foreign religion imported from China and Korea. The reformers very wisely decided that in introducing Christian military technique, they would not attempt to introduce the theology with which it had hitherto been correlated, but would have a nationalistic theology of its own. Shinto, as taught by the state in Japan, was a powerful weapon of nationalism. Its gods are Japanese, and its cosmogony teaches that Japan was created sooner than other countries. The Mikado is descended from the sun goddess and is therefore superior to the mere earthly rulers of other states. Shinto, as taught after 1868, is so different from the other indigenous beliefs that competent students have described it as a new religion. And as a result of skillful combination of enlightenment techniques with unenlightened theology, the Japanese for a time succeeded not merely in repelling the Western menace, but in becoming one of the great powers and achieving the third place on the sea. Japan has been extraordinarily sagacity in the adaptation of the science to political needs. Science as an intellectual force is skeptical and somewhat destructive of societal coherence, while as a technical force it has precisely the opposite qualities. The technical developments due to science have increased the size and intensity of our organizations, and have more particularly greatly augmented the power of governments. Governments have therefore good reason to be friendly to science. Yes, they do, don't they? Governments have therefore good reason to be friendly to science. So long as it can be kept from dangerous and subversive speculations. In the main of men of science, in the main, the men of science have shown themselves amenable. The state favored one set of superstitions in Japan and the other in the West. but the scientists both of Japan and of the West have some exceptions, been willing to acquiesce to governmental doctrines, because most of them are citizens first and servants of the truly of the truth only in the second place. The Nazi experiment, like that of the Japanese, was brought to an end by defeat in war. In each case, it is purely speculative. Question how the national psychology would have developed if no foreign influences had intervened. It was impossible to observe, especially in Japan, a certain nervous strain, particularly in the urban populations, attributable to the sudden change of habits and producing a tendency of hysteria. In both countries, it was impossible to keep wage earners acquiescent, except by foreign conquest. Therefore, in the long run, the regime was faced with either internal revolution or the hostility of the rest of the world. Neither system, therefore, had the stability which a legislator would desire to secure by means of a scientific construction. The attempt at scientific construction, which is being made by the Soviet government, is more ambitious than that which was carried through by the Japanese innovators in 1867. It aims at a much greater change in societal institutions and at the creation of a society far more different from anything previously known than is that of Japan. The experiment is still in progress, and only a rash man would venture to predict whether it will succeed or fail. The attitude both of friends and enemies towards it has been singularly unscientific. And I'm going to mark my spot. That's a pretty good place to take the last break. Well, let's see here. I think about, a couple of short songs. About 6 minutes, everyone. Be right back.
Lift their voices and fill in the parts life taught to them. At last we'll hear love's sweetest song as it was first conceived in the heart of the great songwriter himself. And it will be perfect. What music there will be when the song of all the ages is sung around the Father's throne. When all God's singers get home.
As we sing here on earth, songs of sadness and
okay, welcome back. About the last, 22, 23 minutes or so. Get my readers and my book. For my part, I am not anxious to appraise the good or evil in the Soviet system, but merely to point out these elements of deliberate planning, which make it so far the most complete example of a scientific society. In the first place, all the major factors of production and distribution are controlled by the state. In the second place, all education is designed to stimulate activity in support of the official experiment. In third place, the state does what it can to substitute its religion for the various traditional beliefs which have existed within the territory of the USSR
In the fourth place, literature and the press are controlled by the government and are such as are thought likely to help it in its constructive purposes. In the fifth place, the family, insofar as it represents a loyalty which competes with loyalty to the state, is being gradually weakened. In the sixth place, the government, as far as war and external policy permit, is bending the whole constructive energies of the nation to the realization of a certain economic balance and productive efficiency, by means of which it is hoped that a sufficient degree of material comfort will be secured by everyone, be secured for everyone. In every other society in the world, there is enormously less central direction than under the Soviet government. It is true that during the two world wars, the energies of the nations were to be considerable extent centrally organized. But everyone knew what this was temporary, that this was temporary. And even at its height, the organization was not so all pervasive as it is in Russia. In that country, there is no reason to expect the intensity of governmental control to diminish, since the central organization of a vast nation's activities is attractive to the organizers to be abandoned readily. What, you mean the last segment? Yes, it is. Comes at us quick again. The Russian experiment may succeed or may fail, but even if it fails, it will be followed by others which will share its most interesting characteristic, namely the unitary direction of the whole nation's activities. This was impossible in earlier days, since it depends upon the technique of propaganda, i.e., upon universal education, newspapers, the cinema, and the wireless. The state has already been strengthened by the railroad, by the railways and the telegraph, which made possible the rapid transmission of news and concentration of troops. In addition to modern methods of propaganda, modern methods of warfare have strengthened the state as against discontent elements. Aeroplanes and atomic bombs it's supposed to be 1938. I didn't think the U.S. started making bombs until 41. Aeroplanes and atomic bombs have made revolt difficult unless it obtains the support of aeronauts and chemists. Any prudent government will favor these two classes and take pains to secure their loyalty. As the example of Russia has shown, it is now possible for men of energy and intelligence, if they once became possessed of the governmental machine, to retain power, even though at first they may have to face the opposition of the majority of the population. We must therefore increasingly expect to see government failing into the hands of oligarchies, not of birth, but by option. In countries long accustomed to democracy, the empire of these oligarchies may be concealed behind the democratic forms, as was that of Augustus in Rome. But everywhere their rule will be undisguised. If there is to be a scientific experimentation in the construction of new kinds of societies, the rule of the oligarchy of opinion is essential.
It may be expected that there will be conflicts between the different oligarchies, but that ultimately some one oligarchy will acquire world domination and will produce the worldwide organization as complete and elaborate as that now existing in the USSR. Such a state of affairs will have both merits and demerits. More important than either, however, is the fact that nothing less will enable society.
Ready.
Such a state of affairs will have both merits and demerits. More important than either, however, is the fact that nothing less will enable a society imbued with scientific technique to survive. Scientific technique demands organization. And the more it becomes perfected, the larger are the organizations that it demands. Quite apart from war, an international organization of credit and banking is necessary to the prosperity not only of some countries, but of all. What? The international organization of industrial production is being rendered necessary by the efficiency of modern methods. Modern industrial plant can easily supply in many directions much more than the total needs of the world. The result of this, which should be wealth, is in fact poverty, owing to competition and war. And in the absence of competition, the immensely enhanced productivity of labor would enable men to arrive at a just compromise between leisure and goods. They could choose whether they would work 6 hours a day and be rich, or 4 hours a day and enjoy moderate comfort. The advantages of worldwide organization, both in preventing the waste of economic competition and in removing the danger of war, are so great as to be becoming an essential condition for the survival of societies possessing scientific technique. This argument is overwhelming in comparison with all counterarguments, and renders almost unimportant the question whether life in an organized world state will be more or less satisfactory than life at the present day. For it is only in the direction of the organized world state that the human race can develop less its abandons scientific technique, and it will not do this except as a result of a cataclysm so severe as to lower the whole level of civilization. The advantages to be derived from an organization world state are great and obvious. There will be, in the first place, security against war and saving of almost the whole effort and expense now devoted to competitive armaments. There will be, one must suppose, a single highly efficient fighting machine employing mainly aeroplanes and chemical methods of warfare, which will be quite obviously irresistible, and will therefore not be resisted. The central government may be changed from time to time by a palace revolution, but this will only alter the personnel of the figureheads, not the essential organization of the government. Rothschild that said that. The figureheads will change, but he will run the government. Takes control of the government's money and you take control of the government. The central government will, of course, forbid the propaganda of nationalism, by means of which, at present day, anarchy is maintained, and will put in its place a propaganda of loyalty to the world state. It follows that such an organization, if it can subsist for a generation, will be stable. The gain from an economic point of view will be enormous. There will be no waste in competitive production, no uncertainty as to employment, no poverty, no sudden alterations of good and bad times. Every man willing to work will be kept in comfort, and every man unwilling to work will be kept in prison. When owing to any circumstances, the work upon which a man has hitherto been employed is no longer required, he will be taught some new kind of work, and will be adequately maintained while he is learning his new trade. Economic motives will be employed to regulate population, which will probably be kept stationary. Almost all that is tragic in human life will be eliminated, and even death will seldom come before old age. Whether men will be happy in this paradise, I do not know. Perhaps biochemistry will show us how to make any man happy, provided he has the necessaries of life. Perhaps dangerous sports will be organized for those whom boredom would be otherwise turned into anarchists. Perhaps sport will take over the cruelty which will have been banished from politics. Perhaps football will be replaced by play battles in the air, in which death will be the penalty for defeat. Video games. It may be that so long as men are allowed to seek death, they will not mind having to seek it in a trivial cause. To fall through the air before a million spectators may come to be thought of a glorious death, even if it has no purpose but the amusement of the holiday crowd. It may be that in such way a safety valve that can be provided for the anarchic and violent forces in human nature. Or again, it may be that by wise education and suitable diet, men may be cured of all their unruly impulses, and all life may become as quiet as a Sunday school. There will be, of course, be the universal language, which will be either Esperanto or Pidgin English. P-I-D-G-I-N, Pidgin English. The literature of the past will be, for the most part, not be translated into this language, since its outlook and emotional background will be considered unsettling. Serious students of history will be able to obtain a permit from the government to study such works as Hamlet and Othello. But the general public will be forbidden access to them on the ground that they glorify private murder. Boys will not be allowed to read books about pirates or Red Indians. Love themes will be discouraged on the ground that love, being anarchic, is silly if not wicked. All these will make life very pleasant for the virtuous. Interesting. Science increases our power to do both good and harm, and therefore enhances the need for restraining destructive impulses. If a scientific world is to survive, it is therefore necessary for that men should become tamer
than they have been. Another interesting, more interesting the further it gets. The splendid criminal must no longer be an ideal and submissiveness, but must be more admired than it has been in the past. What? I gotta read that again. The splendid criminal must no longer be ideal and submissiveness, but must be admired than it has been in the past. In all this, there will be both gain and loss, and it is not within human power to strike a balance between the two. Chapter 13, The Individual and the Whole. The 19th century suffered from a curious division between its political ideas and its economic practice. In politics, it carried out the liberal ideas of Locke and Rousseau, which were adapted to a society of small peasant proprietors. Its watchwords were liberty and equality, but meantime it was inventing the technique which is leading the 20th century to destroy liberty and to replace equality with new forms of oligarchy. The prevalence of liberal thought has been in some ways a misfortune, since it has prevented men of large vision from thinking out in an impersonal manner. The problems raised by industrialism, socialism, and communism, it is true, are essentially industrial creeds, but their outlook is so much more dominated by the class war that they have little leisure to give to anything but the means of achieving political victory. Traditional morality gives very little help in the modern world. A rich man may plunge millions into destruction by some act which not even the severest Catholic confessor would consider sinful, while he will need absolution for a trivial sexual aberration which, at the worst, has wasted an hour that might have been more usefully employed. There is a need for a new doctrine on the subject of my duty to my neighbor. It is not only traditional religious teachings that fails to give adequate guidance on this subject, but as the teachings of the 19th century liberalism, take for example such a book as Mill on Liberty. Mill maintains that while the state has a right to interfere with those of my actions that have serious consequences to others, it should leave free where the effects of my actions are mainly confined to myself. Such a principle, however, in the modern world leaves hardly any scope for individual freedom. As society becomes more organic, the effects of men upon each other become more and more numerous and important, so that these remain hardly anything in regard to which Mill's defense of liberty is applicable. Take, for example, freedom of speech and of the press. It is clear that a society that permits these is thereby precluded from various achievements which are possible to a society that forbids them. In time of war, it is obvious to everybody, because in wartime, the national purpose is simple, and the causation involved is obvious. Hitherto, it has not been customary for a nation in peacetime to have any national purpose except the preservation of its territory and its constitution.
a government which, like that of the Soviet Union, has a purpose in peacetime as ardent and definite as that of other nations in wartime, is compelled to curtail freedom of speech and of the press as much while it is at peace as other nations do when they are at war. The diminution of individual liberty, which has been taking place during the last 35 years, is likely to continue, since it has two continuing causes. On the one hand, modern technique makes society more organic. On the other hand, modern sociology makes men more and more aware of casual laws in virtue of which one man's acts are useful or harmful to another man. If we are to justify any particular form of individual liberty in the scientific society of the future, we shall have to do it on the ground that form of liberty is for the good of society as a whole, but not in the cases of the ground, on the ground that the acts concerned affect nobody but the agent. Let us take some examples of traditional principles which appear no longer defensible. The first example that occurs to me is as regards the investment of capital. At present, within wide limits, any man who has money to invest may invest it as he chooses. His freedom was defended during the heyday of the laissez-faire on the ground that the business which paid best was always the most socially useful. Few men nowadays would dare to maintain such a doctrine. Nevertheless, the old freedom persists. It is clear that in a scientific society, capital would be invested where its social utility is greatest, not where it earns the highest rate of profits. The rate of profits earned depend upon quite accidental circumstances. Take, for example, the competition between railways and buses. Railways have to pay for their permanent way, while buses do not. It may therefore happen that the investor railways are unprofitable and buses profitable, even when the exact opposite is the case for the community considered as a whole. I think that's a pretty good place to stop right there for the day. And I want to say thanks for everyone for coming out. And hope to see you tomorrow. Not going to have a song there, Andy, to end. I'm just going to drop the radio stream. So hope to see everyone tomorrow. Thanks for coming out.